think we'll get started. It's about the right time. A warm welcome to all of you. My name is Marusha Campo, and I'm one of the members of the McGill Alumni Board of Directors. As you know, homecoming is one of McGill's most exciting and long-standing traditions. The McGill of 2009, in many ways, is the same McGill from which you graduated maybe 10, 20, 30, or maybe even 40 years ago. But we have kept up with the times. For example, you may not have graduated from McGill. You may be one of the hundreds of parents of current students who, through Parents Weekend events, have in recent years become as much a foundation of homecoming as returning alumni. And as we welcome parents, we also welcome students, staff, and friends. Homecoming is about all of us together celebrating the McGill community. Thank you for joining us at Classes Without Quizzes, which we tend to refer to by their simple acronym, QUOCS. This very popular series of lectures brings you some of McGill's top academics. This year we have a more exciting roster of QUOCS than ever before. There aren't any papers or exams, which is good. All that's required of you is that you sit back and enjoy what will surely be an informative presentation entitled Conceptions and Misconceptions of Autism by Professor Tara Flanagan. One of McGill's newest faculty members, Professor Flanagan joined McGill's Department of Educational and Counseling Psychology only about a year and a half ago, immediately upon finishing her PhD in the same department. It's not often that McGill hires one of its own PhD students off the bat, but the fact that Professor Flanagan was picked immediately from her graduating class should give you a strong indication of her talent and insight in the field. Her research is concerned primarily with areas of social cognition, social inclusion, and social policy for persons with developmental disabilities. She is particularly interested in the transition from school to the community for young adults with developmental disabilities and in the notions of quality of life for individuals on the autism spectrum. As well, Professor Flanagan is a director of SPARC, which stands for Social Policy Advocacy Research Community, a research group bringing together graduate students from a variety of diverse backgrounds to promote social inclusion among individuals with disabilities. SPARC pursues that goal by emphasizing self-determination, community, and a shared responsibility for successful outcomes. Professor Flanagan's work has appeared in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, Developmental Psychology, and Brain and Cognition, and some of her research is due to appear in Cambridge University's Press's upcoming Developmental Approaches to Mental Retardation, A Look to the Future. I just want to mention a couple of things. If you have any cell phones or pagers, if you could please put them on silent or on off. This session is being recorded, so we'd like to keep it as clear as possible for future listeners of it. You will also be able to download it afterwards. And also, if you have a question for Professor Flanagan, please turn on. You each have a little mic in front of you, and there's a button. So you press the button, you speak into the mic so we can all hear the question, and then we'll take it from there. You can turn it off after that. So please join me in welcoming a gifted psychologist, scholar, and lecturer, Professor Tara Flanagan.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. One of my own personal goals is to do a better job of taking compliments. I had no idea that that would be such a lovely and compliment-filled welcome. So thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you to the organizers of the event. And to McGill, as was mentioned, I am an alumni myself, an alumnist. I graduated with my PhD in Educational and Counseling Psychology in 2008, so I'm a bit of a newbie, as the term in our department. However, I've been at McGill since 1999 when I started my master's degree, and I came specifically I came from Winnipeg. I grew up in Manitoba. I went to the University of Winnipeg, and I came here specifically because of the great reputation that McGill has in its graduate work and for the innovation that was afforded me in the department that I currently am in. So it's both humbling and very exciting to be in the department that I graduated from, to be teaching some of the courses that very esteemed professors have taught previously and who I looked up to. So I'm very excited to be here. So I'll talk a little bit about conceptions and misconceptions of autism today. I'm only going to have time to address three common misconceptions, but feel free if there are things that you have questions about to jot them down. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you have. I take a little bit of a disability studies approach, and I work from a developmental perspective, which I think is a great middle ground between a medical model of disability that focuses solely on disorder and illness, and a social model which essentially talks about labels and categories not existing. So somewhere in the middle is where I stand. How I got in the field actually started in Winnipeg, as you might imagine. I was a psychology student at the University of Winnipeg. I was putting myself through school, working at a gas station out in the cold, in the winters, pumping gas. And I didn't necessarily have a solid idea of where I was going with all of that. And by chance, in the neighborhood where I was doing my gas station work, there was a group home that had six adults who had developmental disabilities living in the community. And they would come for a coffee every morning at the gas station, and we developed a bit of a friendship. And one day I finally mustered up the courage to ask if there was any room for staff members at the home, and it turns out there was a recent vacancy. So I went for an interview without any real qualifications, and instead I, at the door, received six hugs. That was my way in, and that was pretty much the catalyst for where I am today. And the reason why I was particularly interested in autism actually stemmed from that work. There was a woman whose name was Teresa, who was a middle-aged woman with developmental disabilities, who really sparked my interest in autism. And the other thing I'll say about that experience is I feel so fortunate that I was able to start working with adults who have developmental disabilities, because this is something that we don't see terribly often. Often we think only of children who have disabilities, especially in autism. So this was great for me. The policy there at the home was of lifelong learning. So everybody had goals that were being set up by them and working toward developing in their own personal ways. So this was something that I feel was immeasurably great for me to be able to start off my career. So I'm going to get started on this portion here. I know it was said that you just need to sit back and enjoy, but I actually do want you to think and maybe jot a few things down for yourselves as well. I hope that's okay. So I want you to think now about your conceptions of autism. So to you, what is autism? Write a few things down. I'll give you, 30 seconds to do that. Okay, so I see some frantic writers and some who are very sure with their short list. So it's always nice to see that there's a range. Next, I want you to think about whether some of the things that you've written down could possibly be misconceptions of autism. And thinking if that actually is the case, where these may have come from. So again, I'll give you another 20 seconds and then I'll move on with the sitting back and relaxing part of the talk. Okay. So, first I'm going to get started on just thinking about what a concept is at its very basic level. And then I'm going to move on and talk a bit more about what some of the misconceptions are that we have in the autism field. Again, I'm going to have time to speak to three of them, but if there's other ones that you have on hand, by all means, let me know. And then I'm going to talk about concept change, and then recommendations that are specific to the field of autism with regard to concept change. And so some of the things that we can do just as regular members of society, as researchers, as practitioners, as parents, in order to change some of the misconceptions that are in the field in autism. So starting with the notion of concept formation, the human brain is a beautiful machine that tends to like to organize information. There is a plethora of information in the world. So one of the things that the brain does very well is organize things into concepts or categories. And basically, a concept is just a generalization and a tool for categorization. So a lot of the research, and generally this is a good thing, a lot of the research in cognitive psychology suggests that being able to filter and categorize are excellent things. However, in social psychology, we do know that sometimes the categorization can also lead to things like discrimination and stereotypes. So it's important to think of some of the ramifications of these as well. So the concept formation part comes often from repeated information in the environment. Often, especially early on in concept formation, these happen to be physical kinds of processes. Reminds me of when my daughter was learning the concept of drain in the bathtub, and she would have a temper tantrum and cry every time she was in the tub. It occurred to me that she recognized, you know, what drains were for, and her fear was that she was going to go down the drain with, you know, the dirty water. So, you know, that's a great example of early development of concepts. And again, from the social psychology research, we know that what we tend to remember usually fits in with our concepts. So, you know, if we have a particular definition of something, a concept of something, when we look in the world, if it fits with that, then we tend to remember it. So, you know, this, again, when we think of the autism world, this comes into play in a very real-life way for students who are in classrooms. So teachers who have specific conceptions about autism, for example, out in society, just, you know, taking the metro, all sorts of activities, we are always operating with these conceptions and often misconceptions of things. And a great example that I can think of comes from one of my students who was in a class of mine last year who had extensive work in the field of autism and worked for a school where there were a lot of students who had autism. And she talked to me about the one time that it became very clear to her what the general conception of autism is. And it happened in one of her classes that she was teaching, which was a music therapy class. And there were a lot of students with autism. And during that class, there was a news crew filming what was going on because they were doing a story on autism. And during that time, there was an entire hour where everybody was doing their music, sharing back and forth, participating in a very friendly fashion, meeting the goals that were set out for that class. And during that hour, there was one incident where a student had taken the musical instrument of their neighbor, and the neighbor started to cry and became very upset. And, you know, these were very young children, actually, preschool students. And essentially what made it onto the news report was the student crying, having an upsetting time because, you know, in the view of the camera person and the editor, that was autism. It wasn't the rest of the time. In their view, that was autism. So that was what was shown. And it was just a very clear example of, you know, the way that we actually form our conceptions of things. They don't occur in a vacuum, and this is what I'm going to talk to you about here. So like I mentioned, I take a bit of a developmental perspective on things, and the most famous developmentalist who looked at all of the different influences on concept formation and everything in life, development in general, was Uri Bronfenbrenner with the ecological model. And essentially, what I'm going to talk about today are two of the influences on development, on concept formation, that we all experience, but there are numerous. So generally, in the model, you have in the center the individual, their development, their personality, their genetics, all of those factors that actually obviously do have a large impact on behavior and on development. And then the things that are proximal, closer to them, as such as family members, teachers, things like that, and things that become increasingly more distal or removed from the individual, like community programs, all the way to kind of the larger, which involves legislation, media, and things like that. And I'm going to talk about those today. So just starting from this position where we know that all of these are connected. So our conceptions don't come out of the blue. They are definitely related to the things that go on in our environment. So the two things that I'm going to be speaking most about today, the two sources, are media and the research on autism. So in relation to that, I'm going to talk about three common misconceptions and how these are manifested in both of those arenas. So the first misconception that I'm going to talk about is that autism is a childhood disorder. I mentioned before that I work with individuals going from school into the community, into the workforce, and I get the question all the time, literally, are there adults with autism that really exists? So, you know, it just seems to make sense that, you know, children would grow into adults, but that tends to not be the conception, actually. Early intervention is a cure for autism. This will be the second misconception that I'll talk about. And then that autism victimizes. So that I'll be talking from, again, from both the research and the media perspectives on these. So starting off with autism is a childhood disorder. How did we get here? So we really just have to look at a couple things to recognize that, you know, it sounds outlandish, but it's not. Why someone might ask if people with autism exist in adulthood. So in the media, we know that cute sells, I guess, just as much as sex sells and all of those kinds of things. So typically when you see media representations of autism, especially when people are looking for donations and things like that, you tend to look at childhood. Cute little kids, and you know who are afflicted, who are having a difficult time, is pretty much what you see there. The legislation that we have in Canada also really feeds into this misconception. So here we have a policy essentially for early intervention. Families can receive some governmental funding for early intervention for their children if they have autism, but we tend to not go beyond the age of six with the kind of support that we offer to families and to individuals. So, again, it makes it seem as if the issue happens to be a childhood one, not necessarily something that continues. And then in the research priorities, where is the research? Where are the views of adults who are autistic? So, starting with the media representations here. In 2008, the National Autistic Society very simply just started an I Exist campaign, literally for that reason. The question, you know, where are the autistic adults? They exist. They are around. And one of the other reasons, aside from just awareness of the fact that, you know, individuals have autism throughout a lifespan and need program support, all of those kinds of things. In terms of some of the outcomes for adults with autism, because again, it's often a neglected group, some of the outcomes are not necessarily positive. So adults who don't have enough support throughout their lifespan, parents are worried. This is something that I see quite often. As mentioned, I work with the kind of the young adults with autism, and parents are often coming to me and saying, okay, you know, in the school system, we feel some kind of support, some kind of focus on our child, and what's going to happen when they graduate? We have no idea, and it's often a place coming from a place of fear and confusion, concern. There are reports that this is the very first time in history that adults with developmental disabilities are likely to be outliving their parents, and we don't tend to have any kind of supports in place to make sure that individuals can be independently doing that and don't have to rely on their parents into old age. So, like I said, there's a lot of concern in families, and the outcomes themselves are often negative. So a look to the research. What I did here, I wanted to take a look at all of the published research that we have currently in the area. And I wanted to talk about this transition from school into community, into adulthood, and focus on autism. So I used the search engine PsycINFO, which is the typical one in psychology. So when you type in autism research, it is a burgeoning field. There are currently, in academic journals across the world, 12,024 articles on autism. If we look at transition research, we have almost 700, so this area specifically. And then when you combine the two, you draw from that pool of 12,000 and 670, we look at how many are actually about autism and transition into adulthood, and there are actually only 5. So clearly, this is across the world in published research. It's clearly an area of need, so there might be a good reason why we don't know how to best support individuals into adulthood, because we haven't been checking. The information isn't there. So if we look even further, there's only 1 out of that pool of 5 that actually collects data, and it's on 3 adolescents moving into adulthood. So the entire field is kind of resting on the shoulders of 3 adolescents. And aside from that, people are just really scrambling to figure out how to best support students. So again, an area that we clearly need to be thinking about. Okay, so misconception number 2, that early intervention can cure autism. So this is a huge area that people are continually talking about. So what do we know? I'm certainly not here to say that early intervention, should be done away with, that we shouldn't be having programming and all of those kinds of things. What I'm here to say is that I think that we need to do proper research and get good data on the effectiveness of programs. So this misconception, again, how did we get here? So the media, oftentimes we have a lot of anecdotal evidence and not evidence based in good, solid research design for this issue in particular. And this often comes just from the idea that, something is better than nothing. So students or young children should just be a part of programs regardless of how effective they are, because if they have nothing, then they are unlikely to succeed. So, a focus on actual effectiveness of those programs in the research, I think, is also really important. Legislation, again, we only have particular programs that are part of the legislation. So And it's kind of a vicious cycle in a way. So the ones that are a part of our legislation are said to be a part of the legislation because of good research, but we actually don't have very good research on that, and that then limits choice for families as well. So when you're looking for programs for your child, you often have a very short list, and sometimes the list is of only one kind of program that your child is eligible for. So you definitely take away parent choice and empowerment when you legislate for one specific thing. Finally, the research priorities. So one of the ironies, I think, in the field is that we see early intervention, by definition, is meant to improve the quality of life of the individuals who are receiving it. And nowhere in the research do we actually know if it improves quality of life. We don't have those numbers. We don't know what the long-term effects are of certain programs as well. So we just don't have longitudinal research. And most everything is counting. Most everything is quantitative. So again, there's a need there, and I'll show you some slides. So getting to the first point about kind of the earlier the better, if something is better than nothing, we can look at this first point here. Kanner, Leo Kanner, was the first person to talk about autism in 1943. And in 68, did a follow-up of his initial cohort. And this is during a time where there was no intervention programs whatsoever. So every person who was initially identified as having autism did not, go and do anything special. They simply were a part of, school and family and the, kinds of things that were not specialized. And 18%, it was a small cohort, by the way, 18% enjoyed a decent quality of life from that, so without early intervention. A later study by Bernard and colleagues in 2001 looked at the outcomes of a much larger sample, 450 adults with autism, and these were ones who had participated in various kinds of programs, had actually seen some kind of specific educational intervention. And you can see the outcomes here are relatively dismal. I'm certainly not saying that it is because of the interventions that the outcomes are dismal, but just saying that there isn't necessarily always the strongest correlation, I guess, between participating in an early intervention program or an intervention program and then positive outcomes later on. And finally, the last authors, Burgess and Gutstein, in 2007, wrote a paper about how we tend to neglect the notion of quality of life among individuals with autism. It wasn't a research article, it was a review article, so we are still tending to do that. We actually don't have that kind of information. But compared to other disability groups, we don't look at this concept, the quality of life concept. So it's actually quite a large area of study in other disability groups. Self-determination learning curriculums, for example, are a part of a lot of programs that work with other disability groups, but not autism. So, again, clearly a need. Again, taking a look at the published research that we have in the area and highlighting the need for qualitative. So you see the autism research. Qualitative research, which asks the individuals in the study about something or other, either by interviews or questionnaires, but finds out about what the individuals are thinking. There, here we have over 2,000 articles published. When, again, you combine that with autism, you have two. And when you actually ask individuals with autism in your study about whatever it is that you're talking about, there are zero. So in these two articles, the people who were asked about what was going on were either parents or educators working with the individuals in a program. I'll just move this, sorry. So again, you know, all of this research, we have 12,000 articles on autism, and not one person with autism has been asked about anything going on in that research, about how they feel about what's going on in their minds when they're going through the, you know, the questions, going through the task that is being asked of them. So again, we clearly have a hole here. And if we're talking about quality of life, this is something that actually is a two-part kind of concept. You have objective components to the quality of life, like things that we would consider to be typically successful, like having jobs, having relationships. But then there's the subjective component, and this is something we're definitely missing out on in autism research because we've never asked. So what does it mean to be successful when you're autistic? I don't know. No one's ever asked. So, you know, this subjective component to research, we really need to be getting started as well. And I think one of the reasons why we tend to also not ask is because autism, which is a spectrum, there is a wide range of abilities. So there are some individuals who may not have expressive language, but that certainly doesn't mean that they can't be asked in a different way, asked to either write or to use, you know, picture communication, another mode. So here, this slide that I have here, I don't know if you can read that far, but for us to do a good job, I think we need to be asking the questions and valuing alternative representations and responses. So this, if you can't see in the back, this is a little boy mooning a fellow, and his mom says, "Michael, use your words." So again, really important that that we make sure that we're asking in a way that the participants in our studies can contribute. So again, one of the misconceptions that also tends to come from this is the notion of sentience. So it's often assumed that individuals with autism may not have any idea of what they're thinking or feeling, which is simply not true. And we need to be a bit more creative in finding out ways to ask. And I think the other component of that often is if individuals aren't very well practiced in self-reflection, it often has to do with the fact that, you know, they've never been asked to do so either. So it is something that you get better with over time. It's not something that's inherently good. I know it's something that I've had to practice throughout my life as well. Okay, so moving on to misconception number three. And this is that autism victimizes. So again, I'm going to take a look at the media and focus a little bit more heavily on the media representations here, specifically autism awareness campaigns, and talking about lack of self-determination research out in the field. So first, yes. So it essentially creates victims in both the individuals with autism and families. So that you're afflicted and removes your power in a lot of ways. That, you know, it's kind of like the most horrific thing that could occur is often how it's presented. Okay. So autism awareness campaigns tend to be have a very small picture of autism. They don't provide kind of an overall holistic view of an individual with personality and all sorts of things, strengths, difficulties, as any other person would often be presented. They tend to focus very much on the negative components that are sometimes associated with, you know, some individuals. It's certainly not the across-the-board way of viewing autism. You certainly don't get a holistic picture. So I'm going to start. So this notion of awareness on Autism Awareness Day in April this past year. This is just a sampling of a couple of the headlines. So progress is slow in the war against autism. Again, you know, it's something that is kind of predatory. We need to fight against something that is, you know, taking over. World Autism Awareness Day shines a bright light on autism as a growing global health crisis. Again, this kind of fear of what might be going on. And I'm going to show you next an awareness campaign that was put forward by New York University in 2007, and it was called the Billboards Campaign. So it had an array of different difficulties, disabilities that would simply be posted on a billboard in New York City in and of themselves without anything. And the idea was to create some awareness about the different issues. And I'm going to show you the two from the Autism Spectrum series. So the first is for Asperger's Syndrome. We have your son. We're destroying his ability for social interaction and driving him into a life of complete isolation. It's up to you now, Asperger's Syndrome. So, again, these would be presented kind of in isolation, no explanation, certainly not a holistic idea of what somebody who had Asperger's Syndrome. Certainly, you don't have many expectations for them into adulthood. You know, there's be completely isolated. Not having any kind of a life is kind of what you'd get from that. Now, autism, we have your son. We'll make sure he'll not be able to care for himself or interact socially as long as he lives. This is only the beginning. So, again, these were put out by, I would say, well-meaning individuals who are academics, who were all working in the field. Here, the case is even more dismal. You see, someone will never be able to even take care of themselves. They won't be able to do the basics for as long as they live. So I wonder why parents are concerned in general about their children and what they will do, you know, once they are no longer around. And, you know, so you have this fear component. And other organizations are using autism as a component for you to fear, you know, what their mandate happens to be. And PETA, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, can't seem to really treat people with autism ethically. I guess that's what's here. So you're trying to scare you about autism, that cow's milk and autism have been related. And this, if I have time after, I can also show you a new, what time is it? I don't know what time it is, but, okay. Oh, actually, I do still have time. So I'm going to show you now. So these, interestingly, are also related to the things I'm going to talk about in the next section on self-determination. The Ransom Notes campaign and the PETA ads were completely taken down by a letter-writing campaign from autistics. So, you know, this is essentially, you know, the way, I think one way anyway, that it is being clearly demonstrated that adults with autism have some power, and they tend to have this power in online communities, tend to be advocates, again, usually online. But so all of these were removed, and I'm going to show you a video right now that this so you're going to be very current in the disability studies discourse out in the world. This actually was a video that was presented to the UN by a group called Autism Speaks, and this was presented only a few weeks ago and has since been removed, again, by letter-writing campaign and advocacy work on the part of autistics. So here we go. It's just a 3-minute one. And millions of dollars were put into this by, there is a, as you can see here, Academy Award nominated director and Grammy nominated songwriter producer. So I'm not sure if it was worth the very short period of time that it ended up being on, but I'll... going to put it back to the start.
I speak your language fluently, and with every voice I take away, I equate.
Can you actually hear with this mic on? No? I don't know where my AV guy went. Okay, I'll try that again. Yeah, he said to put this.
I am autism. I'm visible in your children, but if I can help it, I am invisible to you until it's too late. I know where you live, and guess what? I live there too. I hover around all of you. I know no color barrier, no religion, no morality, no currency. I speak your language fluently, and with every voice I take away, I acquire yet another language. I work very quickly. I work faster than pediatric AIDS, cancer, and diabetes combined. And if you are happily married, I will make sure that your marriage fails. Your money will fall into my hands, and I will bankrupt you for my own self-gain. I don't sleep, so I make sure you don't either. I will make it virtually impossible for your family to easily attend a temple, a birthday party, a public park, without a struggle, without embarrassment, without pain. You have no cure for me. Your scientists don't have the resources, and I relish their desperation. Your neighbors are happier to pretend that I don't exist, of course, until it's their child. I am autism. I have no interest in right or wrong. I derive great pleasure out of your loneliness. I will fight to take away your hope. I will plot to rob you of your children and your dreams. I will make sure that every day you wake up, you will cry, wondering who will take care of my child after I die. And the truth is, I am still winning, and you are scared, and you should be. I am autism. You ignored me. That was a mistake.
And to autism I say...
I am a father.
A mother.
A brother. We will spend every waking hour trying to weaken you.
We don't need sleep because we will not rest until you do.
Family can be much stronger than autism ever anticipated, and we will not be intimidated by you, nor will the love and strength of my community.
I am a parent riding towards you, and you can push me off this horse time and time again, but I will get up, climb back on, and ride on with the message.
Autism, you forget who we are. You forget who you are dealing with. You forget the spirit of mothers and daughters and fathers and sons.
We are
the United Kingdom.
We are China.
We are Argentina.
We are the European Union.
We are the United Nations.
We are coming together in all climates.
We call on all faiths.
We search with technology
and voodoo,
prayer and
herbs, genetic studies,
and a growing awareness you never anticipated.
We have had challenges, but we are the best when overcoming them.
We speak the only language that matters.
Love for our children. Our capacity to love is greater than your capacity to overwhelm. Autism is naive.
You are alone. We are a community of warriors.
We have a voice.
You think because some of our children cannot speak, we cannot hear them? That is autism's weakness.
You think that because my child lives behind a wall, I am afraid to knock it down with my bare hands?
You have not properly been introduced to this community of parents and grandparents, of siblings and friends, and school teachers and therapists, pediatricians and scientists.
Autism, if you are not scared, you should be.
When you came for my child, you forgot.
You came for me. Autism, are you listening?
Okay, I hope you could hear most of that. I'll just close this. Okay, so essentially the letter writing campaign that really shut that down. The campaign that shut that down really forgot, I guess, to consider the individual with autism, the one who is online who views autism as part of their main identity. And for them, it's something clearly that's also not to be eradicated. They take pride in that label and the strengths that that often affords. Very few parents that I've talked to, and specifically very few self-advocates, individuals with autism, when they're asked if they would want it any other way, very few say that they would. So clearly by taking the approach at, eradicating autism in that campaign, they weren't really focusing on autism awareness. And on a lifespan of individuals with autism, clearly, simply on a very medical model approach. So this also people have asked for apologies. Some have come, but certainly from the group, it wasn't a very thorough apology. But that's where, currently this discourse is, and it's a very current one, like I mentioned only a few weeks ago. So now turning back to the research, autism, which, tends to victimize according to this conception or misconception, that, individuals don't have any power against it. From that, we also see kind of everybody getting together against autism, which I don't think is necessarily the most productive approach. But if we look at, again, the research that we see in the area of self-determination, which is about making individual choices, having some volitional control over one's life, goals, all of those kinds of things, we see around 1,500 articles in self-determination. And again, if we look at self-determination and autism, there are only 5 published articles. So clearly, what we can see from the three misconceptions that I've talked about and the evidence that from the research as well as from media, they really do converge in a very strong way and portray individuals with autism and their parents as victims, as we see, where they're powerless in a way to have a life, to develop in a way that is meaningful. Individuals also, according to that, are unable to speak for themselves and to make important life decisions. So this is something that you see from both sides. And then research and intervention agendas move forward without ever consulting the autism community. So in my view, these are the things that, in order to address the misconceptions, we need to be talking about. And the thing that I want to talk about is concept change, which is something that was put forward by Posner and colleagues in 1982. And there are 4 conditions to concept change, and I'm going to talk about each of them in relation to autism, starting with the next slide. But at the basic level, so the concept that we have of autism, the misconception of autism, this, if we're going to have any kind of impact on changing the notion that we have of it, we need to start with a dissatisfaction with the current concept. There are certainly pockets of society where there is a lot of dissatisfaction with the concept, but it may not be kind of a more, societal trend. That the correct concept, so what you'd like to change it to, is intelligible, that it's understandable, it makes sense. Also, that this new concept is reasonable, so in some ways, you know, practical, valid, and finally, that it needs to be fruitful. And when I think of this fourth one, I also tend to think of, again, that ecological model. It needs to be fruitful for the individual. It needs to be fruitful for the family. It needs to be fruitful in the workplace, in education, in society. So if we're going to change this conception of autism, it needs to be fruitful to a variety of stakeholders. So some recommendations that I put together based on each of those levels. So condition one, dissatisfaction with the current concept. We can see from the letter writing campaigns, the strong advocacy in, you know, the online communities, that there is a dissatisfaction with the current conception by autistics who are online and who identify as autistic and being proud of that label. We also need to take a lifespan perspective and make sure that we're changing this notion of, you know, autism is a childhood issue, that, you know, we can't be satisfied to allow individuals with autism to grow into adults and have no opportunities, no place in the workforce that, you know, is inviting and meaningful. And the other thing that's really important is to just take a critical eye when, you know, we're faced with media representations and also, you know, the interpretations of research findings. Something, it always is very informative to me, and I'm always kind of surprised by how in the discussion sections of research articles, the interpretations are often very negative, and they're not as objective, I think, as we'd like to think they are in research. So interpretation always is a little bit subjective, and we just have to make sure that we're aware of that. The second one, the correct concept must be understandable. So we currently don't have a great idea, I guess, about what autism is, other than you know, the typical definition, which involves language difficulty, communication, and repetitive behavior. So we know that. We, among professionals, don't collaborate a lot. Researchers don't collaborate with practitioners. We tend to not ask individuals with autism about things that are affecting their lives. So we need to have a much more cohesive approach to the study of autism. So that way it is understandable across all levels. Everybody, you know, will have a sense of what the, you know, new concept, correct concept would be. User-friendly reporting of results and explanations, again, really make it very, very much more viable. Okay, the third condition, the correct concept must be reasonable and valid. So in order for this kind of thing to happen, we need to be, as researchers, asking good questions, going outside of the box a little bit, being more flexible, and involving the autism community. So, you know, the kinds of things that we've asked so far have been very quantitative, you know, very specific, and in the words of a sign hanging in Albert Einstein's office, reportedly, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. So as researchers, very important to remember these things. We, I think, need to expand our view a little bit about what research is, what's important, and the easiest and cheapest way to get at what's important is to start asking the community, start asking parents, start asking people with autism. And then finally, the fourth condition, the correct concept must be fruitful. This, I think, is probably the most difficult. And like I mentioned, I think it's the most difficult because it involves being fruitful to a variety of stakeholders. So how do you get that to be? You know, who wants to put money into autism research when, you know, you're presenting individuals as more holistic and doing better? So, you know, a different model often provides more money. So we need to think about it kind of on a large scale. Legislation that supports a lifespan perspective, that's part of it. President Obama, before he was president, put forth four points on autism in his website, and one of them was taking a lifespan approach to the study of autism, and I hope that services are provided throughout a lifespan and that we start to think of individuals as individuals on the developmental path. Creating programs for families and autistics that actually address their needs. Again, that also involves asking them what their needs are, but actually providing the things that they need as opposed to cookie-cutter programs and things that don't necessarily address their needs. More flexibility in schools, community activities, and workplace. So this involves, I guess, opening up to different ways of doing things. It's so funny when in the autism community, people often talk about rigidity and not being able to step out of themselves. But in the larger society, in workplaces, in education, in the classroom, we often are very rigid about what we'll accept as appropriate and what we won't. So, is it the end of the world if someone doesn't look you in the eye when they're talking to you? Or, for example, one of the individuals who I worked with liked to provide affection by rubbing your forehead, which was very nice, as opposed she didn't like having a hug, and this was considered to be a negative thing. It's still affection. It's still a connection. Maybe we need to be a little bit more flexible about some of those things. I'm not saying this, is the only approach. We can certainly work with some of the educational programs, but I think we also have a responsibility to be more flexible and accepting of different ways of doing things. In my view as a developmentalist, there are different paths to the same end, and I think that's something that hopefully we can see more on a practical level as well. And then finally, a focus on empowerment from parents, which means involving choices, having your needs met, self-determination, being asked, again, having some control over your own life because it's supposed to be meaningful to you, not just meaningful in a traditional sense to everybody else. And what I think is extremely important is the shared responsibility. So we're all going out in our different jobs, doing different things. This responsibility to make sure that we are more open and inclusive and accepting, I think spans all the different levels and all the things that we do. So, it can be just a critical eye on a magazine article on the topic, things like that. But all of those little things make a big difference in the grand scheme. And another Einstein quote, we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. So, again, extremely important, more flexible, open to different ways of doing things. Again, Barack Obama talked about a vision for individuals with disabilities, mostly focused on physical disabilities. But what I put in red here, I think, is very important and very applicable to what we're talking about. So everybody has a chance to get the education they need and live independently as full citizens in their communities. And I would add, in their way, according to, their own personal paths and goals. And I'm going to end with an example, in my view, of great vision. And you see here this beautiful piece of art called Windows by Katrin. Katrin is a young woman who has autism, who in her education programs was placed for jobs in stocking shelves and in a very menial kind of job, factory-type work. And this is the kind of thing that she can do. And I think that it's really important for us to remember that, if people are participating in their lives in the way that they can, that we need to be more flexible. She now, with her family, has created her own business, and she is doing a lot of speaking engagements, showing her work, talking about self-determination, empowering, young individuals with autism. She's going to be speaking here in November at the Miriam Foundation Conference. Really an example of someone who could have essentially stopped at, you know, having a job that wasn't appropriate, but and clearly who has a lot of talents and things that they should be doing. And I think that it's the responsibility of teachers, professionals, just everybody in general to make sure that this is the kind of thing that we're not missing. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Hi.
Thanks very much for your talk. And could you just comment on what you think Mark Haddon's book, The Incident of the Dog in the Night, has done for our perception of autism?
Well, I think one of the... It talks a lot about, you know, attention to detail and things like that. And I think if we're looking at some of the other books, I think it's probably one of the better ones and can... in some ways, at least, be construed as a strength-based kind of book. You know, attention to detail has been viewed as sometimes very focused, but this had, I think, a bit more of a positive spin. I think the fact that there has been a wide readership has also been a really positive aspect to that. Yes.
Can you say a word about one end of the spectrum that you didn't occupy today, that is with respect to differential diagnosis and other causes of behavior or diseases which may be wrongly classified as autism?
Right. Well, if we think also of, I guess I'll maybe step back for a second and think of the larger issue. So there are a lot of different issues, I guess, that can be construed, dysphasia, for example, things like that, that often happen to be diagnosed sometimes as autism. And one of the things that we can't forget, I guess, is the way that our system also works in order to fund programming and to get services in education. Oftentimes, if there seems to be some kind of autism tendencies or features, people will err on the side of autism because they feel that they'll get more services for individual children. So I think it happens more often than we would like to admit, I think, that a lot of things really get labeled autism when they may not be. Yes.
The figures we got from the U.S. government is 150, right. One in 150.
Right.
Now it's one in 100.
Right.
And it's getting worse.
Yes. Now, yeah, I've heard another one in 64.
So, you know, this is an incredible epidemic. The congressional hearings, I've been watching them on C-SPAN, and they get hours and hours of hearings. There's a doctor that sits there, and there's five or six people that have their own cases. And, they're talking about the vaccines. You know, they
right.
used to get four shots 20 years ago. Now they get 28. And they're talking about mercury
right.
and all the things. And the doctors are denying it, and they're just stonewalling and pleading the Fifth Amendment. There's no explanation, but they're saying that it does not cause autism, any of these things that people are seeing the actual evidence in the Midwestern United States.
Right.
And the community colleges, there's no place to put these students now that are 15 and 16 years old. There are over a million of them around in the United States that have no place to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. For me, it's a huge hole, the adult services hole, the preparation for where you might go after school. So in terms of causes and all of that, it is extremely complex, and we still don't have a solid sense of what might be causing, and it is very unlikely that it's one thing. There are, as you know, the debate about vaccines is currently raging. The person who had initially put that forward is being investigated for fraud. And that there's a lot of layers to that debate. So, mm-hmm. I think looking at, again, if you kind of think about the ecological model, there's probably a very complex array, I guess, of causes, and it would vary from individual to individual in some ways, even though there are some commonalities. There's also a lot of talk about those numbers being very much inflated. Some research suggesting that we have as many autistic adults as that we're just not aware of, out in the open, as we do children. So there's there's a lot of conflicting information out there, and I think that that's part of the issue when, you know, we're all trying to come to a common understanding of what might be going on. And it seems that, you know, the response is to then only look into causes. When you have, like you're saying, all these individuals who need some place to go, need something to do, need to be present in their own lives, we need to have a plan and do something about that. We can't just focus on, you know, the genetics that are very complicated and might explain, you know, a certain amount. We need the other as well, the more messy kind of science that, and have a place for people to go. It's a responsibility. Yes.
Hi. I think that there's two issues here. Certainly the issue of acceptance of people with differences, and also the wide spectrum. I mean, someone, a lecturer I went to, said that the largest sheltered workshop in the world is NASA, and the second largest is probably universities, right, where you're getting a lot of people with Asperger's and looking at detail. And I think that in our society, yes, we have to accept people with differences and find place for them. But I think it's the huge issue is, why is there the increase in the numbers, even if they're inflated?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a practitioner, and I'm working with children at the lower end of the spectrum, and it's just burgeoning. And where are they? Where were they 40 years ago?
Yeah.
Were they non-existent, or did we put them in institutions? What's the difference now?
Right.
And I think it's that we have to focus on the causes, and you know, I think so. I didn't find that video so offensive because I think what it's saying is, we love our children, and you're not going to stop us from loving our children and giving them what they need. But let's find out where is this all coming from, and stopping this epidemic is somewhere.
I think that's important as well, to take a look at that. But I think it can't be the only focus, and there needs to be more of a holistic approach. I guess we need to make sure that we do have services, we have good research into programs. Certainly we can be looking into causes. I think that's important. But to focus solely on that, I think we're really missing a lot of individuals who are currently, you know, developing and who need, you know, support for life, however that happens to be, wherever they are on the spectrum. So, yeah, definitely you need to be looking at more than just one area. Yes. Yeah, I'll look on this side. Yes.
I'm curious, not just transitioning, but as you transition to the new world, what do you do with all the people who are actually in their 30s or 40s, particularly those who are not so high functioning, they can be independent?
Right. Yes, so there are, and I'm working actually and my students are working in a variety of different programs for a variety of different needs. So I'm working in conjunction with the Office for Students with Disabilities here at McGill to work toward putting in a program to support the individuals who are on the spectrum at university. So there's that level. I'm also working with one of the readaptation centers to put in kind of a skills program, which has actually been going on for about a year, for individuals, again, who are after school and right before kind of going out into the world. We have a list that I have been told is sometimes 7 years long for the kinds of programs, the work programs and things like that. So we needed to work with something. And what was I going to say? my third point. But definitely there are some programs, but there needs to be a better integrated approach. There aren't enough programs, and oftentimes they're not terribly well-tailored. I work with another program at Champlain College here, which is a post-secondary inclusive program called Adams Pace, and it's for students who have developmental disabilities who are part of the Riverside School Board, and they take classes at the college level as well as life skills, vocational skills, go on stage, I have one of the stagiaires actually working in my research lab and doing a stage at McGill at the moment. And this was a huge undertaking, and there was a lot of, initially, a lot of negative response. But what's actually happened, because students audit courses, is that the professors tend to be happier to have the students in their class because they actually do the readings and actually participate compared to the other college students. So, you know, these are the kinds of things anyway. But there's such small steps, I guess, in getting. We need a better integrated approach and more people focused on that area. So there's not a lot of places. And if we even look at the Canadian legislation about the recommendations that we have for workplaces, there's four bullet points about how to work with individuals in your workplace who have developmental disabilities of various kinds, and they're lumped in with psychiatric disorders. So we don't have a great idea of how to make that cohesive. Thanks. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm an educator, and I like to know, is it a problem for an autistic child to have two languages at home?
Right. I guess first, in terms of research, we actually don't know a lot about that. I do know that some people are starting on that research path here in Montreal, which is great. Developmentally, in other groups, having two languages has often been considered to enhance development and language production, but we don't have a solid sense. I know that there are some professionals in the area as well, looking at you, Nancy, who may be better at answering that question. But my guess would probably be that it would enhance, but there tends to be that that concern that it would be overwhelming for both to be present. Research will tell, I guess. Maybe Nancy will respond there.
The reality is that if a set of parents and grandparents are living in the same house or an upstairs, downstairs duplex, and it adds tension into the whole family situation to try to get the parents to speak only one language, that the tension can underdo the make more of a problem than the two languages. So sometimes, you know, if the Italian parents are downstairs and the child spends a lot of time with them, it isn't doing the child a service to not speak Italian.
Thank you. In the back?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Okay. One is, if you think the word, the term neurally atypical or neurotypical, you know, the two terms, if you find those helpful because they kind of open up like a spectrum of ways of looking at the world. And number two, do you think that there's a danger with, like, sort of the Rain Man phenomena that autism has become kind of romanticized as well?
Right. I think, yes, the new terminology, and it's also been adopted by many autistics, the NTs, the neurotypicals, would be considered. So it's part of the neurodiversity approach to thinking about these kinds of things, which is a lot more flexible. And, you know, I think that that's a good thing. It certainly doesn't suggest that there's, that, you know, there might not be difficulties, for example, but just that, you know, there's a range of ways of thinking, which I think is positive. The second portion.
Whether you think that, you know, find very high-functioning autistics with exceptional powers, like the guy
right.
can learn language in 1 week,
yeah.
And Temple Grandin,
right.
That you can
yeah.
sort of romanticize it.
Yes, absolutely. So I think anytime, you know, when we're talking about the information that, you know, for thinking of concept change, which I talked about, oftentimes people say, you know, well, why don't we just put all these, you know, great examples of people who have done wonderful things, and there are a lot of them. And I think it's actually even more powerful to just put kind of a regular person, a regular kid, changing the concept, because you end up with this view sometimes that the individuals who have these abilities that are really quite remarkable don't represent everybody. And so then you discount the rest of, you know, the individuals who don't have these special kinds of abilities that, you know, that we see. So, yeah, it's so complicated to think of the best way, I guess, of making sure that people are
you know, supported and their views are, you know, that we're flexible enough that we take that approach. But then we also have room for being able to do intervention and look at causes and things like that. So, you know, it is quite a balancing act to make sure that all of the components that we really do need, because there are certainly a lot of individuals who really do need some kind of help and intervention, that how are we making sure that it's the right intervention, that it's going to be useful, that we're still asking individuals, making sure that they're present in all of these. And how all these pieces fit together to make sure that we're providing the best service and the best environment for individuals. Yes.
I'm also a practitioner, and I think there's a lot of pressure on us to look for the very most subtle signs of autism.
Yes.
Because this idea that we can cure it if we catch it early, and so, I mean, you try and find more and more subtle things that indicate autism so you can get the kid treatment. And, I mean, there's bound to be more kids being diagnosed because, I mean, we're just looking that much harder because this is what's, you know, we're being told. You diagnose it early, you don't miss any, you pick up the subtle signs, they're not cuddling, okay, maybe they're autistic.
Right.
You know, so then you get this huge number of kids that are maybe autistic, and better to diagnose than not so that they get the treatment, so that they get cured. You know, that's the medical model, and I think it's contributing to having a larger number.
Right. I think one of the interesting things that you brought up, too, was that the pressure. And, you know, practitioners have a lot of pressure, you know, to be able to, you know, show progress, all those kinds of things. And I think that the pressure that we haven't talked about yet really is also on parents. So if you look at the history of autism from, you know, 1943 until now, starting, I guess, with Bettelheim after Kanner, and the pressure that was on parents has really shifted. So there's been a big pendulum swing. So initially, mothers especially were blamed for autism as refrigerator mothers. They took on this responsibility as being the cause. And now the pendulum has swung so in the other direction that now you're not, you know, to blame for autism, but for sure you're going to be the one to take care of it. You know, you need to work in programs for your children, in the interventions. You need to be an expert on autism, all these things. And in reality, you're a parent. You're not an autism expert. You're not anything. You know, your job generally and first should just be an expert on your child and, you know, socializing your developing child as any other parent would. So, you know, we have this pressure now on parents that is so different from where it has come. And I think either one of those is extremely overburdening parents. So I see lots of hands over here. Okay. Yes. Oh, were you there first? Okay, sure. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Can you press your microphone? Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, all right. I just wanted to say that social pressure is the first on my list, too, of questions.
Okay.
And do you, when you approach the problems, do you divide up social or, say, cognition and the whole idea that the problems that might be social in nature? It seems to me it would be better and more effective to divide them up, which is not typical.
Yeah, no, you're right. It doesn't happen that way. So one of the best practices when you're doing, for example, IQ testing, which hasn't been the typical practice, but now one of the best practices is to make sure that you use a culture fair nonverbal test of IQ. So you're looking at fluid intelligence, something like the lighter R or something like the Ravens. So that way you're not adding in that problematic component of language and social things. It's simply nonverbal, and people with autism in the published research tend to be doing well in terms of these when they're not, you know, intertwined with a difficult area like language or social interaction.
That was my, and the second thing I wanted to say was homeschooling. What do you think of homeschooling then for small children?
Well, a lot of parents often take that route because they are very concerned about bullying and certain issues. I I don't necessarily, I'm not an advocate for or against homeschooling. I think that it certainly has its place with a good educational program. A lot of parents, however, want to make sure that, you know, the peer, that there's more practice for peer interactions and things like that. That's kind of the, yeah. Yes.
Does a young adult become aware that he or she is autistic, or do you broach the subject, or how do they get to identify that themselves, and how do they respond to that?
So this is one more question after this. Okay. It's an interesting topic because it's very much tied into identity. So we now, in the field, tend to diagnose much earlier than we used to. So one of my favorite autistic people of all time, Michelle Dawson, received a diagnosis of autism when she was an adult. So, you know, her identity, I guess, as an autistic adult didn't have that kind of history. Whereas now, so if you're diagnosing at 18 months, 2 years, the person has never developed an identity outside of that label. So it's certainly an issue that could really have an entire discussion for a good amount of time on it. But I would certainly, the recommendation that I make, I guess, certainly if you're receiving a diagnosis a little bit later, is to have a balanced approach and, you know, for teachers, for example, to find ways that students can be proud of the, you know, the label that's going to be such a big part of their identity. It doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not a death sentence. It can at least be a component, certainly, if you're receiving it later. And if you're generally receiving it later, you usually are a little bit more mild as well. So, good. And last question, I guess?
Yes.
You can ask me a question after. Sorry.
I wonder if you'd recommend the three best things that grandparents can do to support their kids who have autism.
Good. Well, okay. So, three best things that grandparents can do. One, I would say support your children first. Make sure, you know, to be available. So, and then I'll do the other two recommendations for your grandchildren. But I think that in the research, one of the most important components is having some kind of support for parents. There's a lot of pressures. There's a lot of work goes into parenting generally, and you have such a complicated additional set of things when you're a parent who has a child with autism. So that I would say also try to be flexible. Try to recognize the things that might not be the typical way of, say, showing affection or those kinds of things. That's important. And I would say third, I guess, pick your battles. I'm a parent of a 5-year-old, and I think this is extremely important, and I've had to give her advice on the playground to do this herself. So, you know, the things that are in your view kind of high priorities to make sure to address, you know, whatever they might be, if it might be finding friends or, you know, aggressive behaviors or whatever those, address those. And the things that you might be able to let go of, say some, you know, odd quirks or things like that, to be flexible and let those go, to prioritize the kinds of things that you want to be involved in. So, and support your kids. they need it. Thanks.
I think maybe Professor Flanagan can stay maybe to answer a few other questions,
yeah.
But I know that some of you have other events. So I just wanted Professor Flanagan to thank you very much for your wonderful presentation. I think all of us have learned a lot and can maybe see a different aspect now of how autism is perceived. So I just want you to please accept this small token of gratitude from the Alumni Association.
Thank you very much. And you can come and ask me a question if you're... Yeah.
Thank you to all of you for joining us this afternoon's lecture. By the way, this, as I mentioned before, will be available on the website for download in about a week. And for those of you who have registered for this evening's reception, don't forget to join us in the lobby of the Arts Building at 5:30. And I hope you enjoy the rest of Homecoming and Parents Weekend. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.